You're listening to Around Comics, episode 203, Extreme!
This is Around Comics, the comic culture podcast, where each week our revolving panel of guests talk about everything in and around the world of comic books and comics culture. And Around Comics is recorded at Dark Tower Comics and Collectibles, located at 4835 Northwestern Avenue in Chicago. If you're in the area, please drop by. This episode of Around Comics is sponsored by InStockTrades.com, where waiting for the trade has never been easier. InStockTrades.com offers a huge selection of the collected editions you need. InStockTrades is your source for trade paperbacks, deluxe hardcovers, essentials, showcases, archives, absolute editions, omnibus editions, and more, all at great discounted prices. And remember that all orders over $50 do in fact ship for free, and right now, InStockTrades.com is offering our new book club selection, Tom Beland's True Story, Swear to God, Archive, Volume 1, for a fantastic 47% off the cover price. The first 17 issues of the six-time Eisner-nominated series are collected here and available to you for a mere $10.59. That's at InStockTrades.com. Hey there, everybody. I'm Christopher Niesman, and joined alongside by Mr. Tom Caters. Tom, how you doing?
I'm good. I'm drinking a camouflage can of Tall Boy of Miller High Life.
That's a classy-looking can of beer there.
It's a limited edition fall series. It says, enjoy after the adventure, which I assume is hunting is an adventure.
Or the baseball playoffs.
Or whatever. Or sitting alone in your apartment drinking Miller. The adventure of sitting on your couch and drinking High Life.
I think that's probably more apt.
Yeah. That's the closest I'm going to get to hunting, is looking for the
really?
Next one.
I told you I used to hunt squirrel, right?
Oh, my God.
All right, that's another story.
My dad took me, wanted to take me hunting, but I was too much of a fancy lad. dad knows about cars and, like, hunting, and I...
Have you ever hunted moose?
No, I do not know how to strip a moose. I don't know how to... I know nothing about foreign policy.
Have you ever shot wolves out of an airplane?
I tried my damnedest.
Can you see?
It was a paintball gun, though.
Can you see Russia from your house?
No, I've seen Canada.
Okay.
So,
well, you're from Wisconsin.
And Canada touches Lake Michigan.
All right.
We're already piling.
Yes, I know.
Already, even though we told ourselves
that. 3 minutes
in. The subtle Sarah Palin,
Palin
jokes,
yeah.
will end now.
She's my favorite fictional character of the last 2 years.
Let's introduce our next guest, a fellow Chicagoan, actually the owner of Short Pants Press, Miss Sarah Beacon. How you doing?
Hello. I'm fine. How are you?
All right. Good to have you. And Sarah, by the way, is going to be one of our exhibitors and guest at the Windy City Comic Con.
Around Comics is proud to present the Windy City Comic Con. Join us on October 25th from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. at the Center in Halsted, just 2 blocks from Wrigley Field in the heart of Chicago's Wrigleyville neighborhood. This one-day event will bring together the best comic book retailers, publishers, and creators in the Midwest. The area's best retailers will be offering great deals on new issues, collected editions, statues, games, toys, apparel, and tons, literally tons of back issues. Meet some of the Midwest's best talent, including Gene Ha, Don Kramer, Mike Norton, Chris Burnham, Will Pfeiffer.
That's Pfeiffer. Pfeiffer. You know how to say Will's name.
Will P. Bill Reinhold. Doug Klauba. Jesus. Rich Kozlowski.
Kozlowski you get. Doug Klauba you can't say.
Jeffrey Brown. Tim Saley. So that's the... I know Tim. That's Tim Saley. And many more. Book
and
your plans now.
And Sarah Beacon.
And Sarah Beacon. He's here. book your plans now to attend the Windy City Comic Con visits coming shortly.
Mm-hmm.
You should. Now, for a full list of exhibitors, guests, gaming schedules, there will be gaming there, and programming, go to www.windycitycomiccon.com. That's Comic-Con, spelled C-O-M-I-C-O-N.com. The Windy City Comic Con, Chicago's only comic book convention.
Yay!
And it's only $5 to get in, right?
Exactly.
You can't afford not to go.
This isn't just for the wealthy small press publishers. You know, those wealthy owners of small
press. Yes, yes, the short pants press empire that you have built.
I'm only in it for the money.
All that money in comics.
You know, we actually announced our programming schedule, which if you are...
Comics, don't get into it. There is no money.
Yes. Run away now. No, if you are an aspiring comic book creator or someone that's just interested in the process, we're going to have a writing class with Will Pfeiffer and Josh Elder and Mike Kennedy. Scotty Young's going to do a drawing class. It's called Drawing Comics the Awesome Way, as only Scotty can.
He's going to sabotage all these people.
Jason Malay is going to do a class on coloring for comics in the digital age. And then we've got four gentlemen that are going to be doing a little seminar on publishing comics to the web.
What about inking? Nobody's...
You know, I got to talk
to... Or tracing.
Nice.
No inkers here to piss
off. You know, we may have to talk to Hillary and see if he would do that.
You don't want people to learn from him, though.
No. Bill Reinhold.
They both seem like they could go off at any... like
it's not tracing!
Yeah. Short fuses on those two. I think we need to get someone with a little...
But it'll be,
get Mike Norton to teach a class.
Oh, Mike hates inking.
Mike... One thing I know about Mike, if I know Mike well, is that he loves to share knowledge with other people. And he loves to deal with new... Because there are no strangers. His friends he hasn't met yet.
He doesn't do that because he's afraid that people are going to take his job.
So then this is his opportunity to sabotage, but teaching them completely wrong. Wrong technique.
Anatomy is not important.
It's not important.
At all.
Storytelling, useless. But stupid. It's stupid.
Silhouettes and big eyeballs.
Right? Yeah, exactly.
So, anyway, it should be a fun time. Pre-register if you can. It's a great way to reserve your gift packs, which you'll hear all about on the subsequent episodes, or go to the website.
Gift bags. Free stuff.
Yes, free stuff. We love the free stuff.
Comic book fans love free stuff.
Hey, we got a lot of that. Today's episode,
yes.
And you can hear the sirens in the background because they know we're going to talk about this. This is our Politics in Comics episode, and we're probably going to have a few more guests as the show goes on to kind of pick us up and give their insights. But there are other podcasts that are talking about politics and comics right now. There's a whole theme month going on, and you can find other participating podcasts by going to comicrelated.com, and it will have them listed there. But we are going to do our Around Comics style version of covering this topic. We haven't done a wide sweeping topic like this in quite a long time.
Ages.
So it's been a long time since we had a topic based episode. So
a lot of time.
Well, we'll see if we can hop right back
it's
on
crash the and burn, or
it could be
it's rise triumphantly.
Well, the first thing I had in mind for this episode was to ask the question first and foremost: do politics belong in comics? Should comics have political messages in them? So, I mean,
let's ask our Republican panel member.
Oh, I feel like I just got slandered.
she's piling on.
No,
I mean, I don't know. I hesitate to say, that anything should or should not be allowed in comics. I mean, from the point of view of a creator, I would sort of bristle at the idea that any sort of topic would be considered off limits in any genre. But also from the point of view of a creator, I think that you run a danger if you get a little too specific with politics and comics of it being less universal, less eternal of a message. If you look back at, say, what was going on in the 30s with the superheroes, nobody really goes back and reads the ones where Superman beat up Hitler, or that had derogatory...
That would be Captain America.
See, already I'm embarrassing myself.
Sorry.
But, I don't know, that sort of message, eventually fades, because a politician can only be in power for so long. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's funny because, like, Alice in Wonderland is really an allegory about the gold standard. But nobody remembers.
No, it's true.
Wizard of Oz. Did I say Alice in Wonderland?
Yes.
I meant Wizard of Oz, with the yellow brick road and, it's an allegory about the gold standard, but time, no one now knows what the fuck the gold standard is or why people were debating it, but the story is good enough and interesting enough to people that it has surpassed its own its initial origin of what it is. And I mean, you can take a look at all those great Marvel stories about Adlai Stevenson that no one understands now. Kidding, I get Adlai.
Poor Adlai Stevenson. Only people in Illinois know who Adlai Stevenson is.
Poor Adlai, old egghead.
Wasn't he the? And we'll digress here. Wasn't he pretty much lost that election because he refused to run ads on TV? Right. It was.
I think it was one of the big things, right? Yeah, something like that. Yeah.
But going back to politics and comics, I think you make a good point, both of you, is that whatever. And this, I think, we'll get to at the end eventually, is as long as they're good stories, I think you can include anything in your comics. But whenever it starts to encroach on what the actual story is, then you start to run into some serious problems.
Right, exactly. I think the danger, honestly, is specificity more than anything else. I mean, if you were to run a comic book right now that was about the current political campaign, 10 years from now, nobody might care at all. But if you look at a series like
70% of the people now wouldn't care.
It's true. But if you look at a series like Transmetropolitan, mm-hmm. that was inherently very political. In what the character was writing and in the forces that he came up against, but they were more sort of amorphous, eternal political issues that come up all the time. That, you know, there's always politicians who are doing this. There's always governments that are doing this.
I think it's a case too of I think when people say politics and comics, it's like they want. I'm going to use DC Decisions, which we're probably going to bring up, which mm-hmm. is the book they're putting out that's sort of superheroes taking sides politically. But sometimes I think people, when they hear politics, it's like you're not. The right way to do it isn't necessarily to have your character list what they think about abortion and immigration and all that stuff, because while that people think that is sort of the definition of what your politics is, but I think in reality, and I think in storytelling too, your views on those things are based on deeper things within you and what you believe and the nature of how you look at the world, which is where that gets taken, and if you use it correctly, you can make a really good story based out of those ideals without having your character sit down and like read a list of what they think
right.
about, like
their campaign
here's
platform.
The page about yeah here's the page about taxes and here's the page. I mean, that stuff could come up. Transmetropolitan is a good example. There's stuff like that in there, but it's based more on Spider's broad viewpoint of how the world works as opposed
right.
to specifics, you know, people.
As opposed to what he thought of the capital gains.
Yeah, people think your politics are all based on like what you think. Like everyone gets a checklist of all these things, and you have to mark which one you think, and that's like how you define your politics. But it's really what you think of those things is based on your own beliefs about how the world works, which is the way stories work. You know, story, a character that has a viewpoint about the world is what makes stories interesting. If you just had bland characters who just sort of wandered around mm-hmm. with no viewpoint, then you got boring.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
And sometimes that happens.
And there's a lot of books like that with characters who have no viewpoints.
Sure. Whenever you saw that DC was going to do their Decisions miniseries, which is a four-issue miniseries where the JLA, for I guess one reason or another, they end up taking sides politically in this election that's coming up, and it takes place during the primaries, and for different reasons they have to go out and protect these candidates. What was your initial reaction whenever you saw that DC was going to have a mainstream book with their flagship superhero team that was going to be a politically charged?
I thought it's as if comic book fans who bitch now, who have an incredibly narrow viewpoint on the world, needed any more challenging to their incredible viewpoint on the world. I read it and I was kind of surprised by how well written it was. Mm-hmm. I kind of thought it would be.
Well, it's Bill Willingham and Judd Winnick.
Yeah, well, I was worried because it was Willingham.
But
because it did what I had mentioned earlier, it wasn't like Green Arrow's like, I think we should have open borders, which is just a boring story. It's about what they think about.
There was only one moment in that book that really felt like that. And do you know which one I'm talking about?
I read it a couple weeks ago.
It was Lois, whenever Lois was talking to Clark, and she's trying to.
Well, she stated her beliefs.
Yeah.
But even then, it was still more general than, like, wasn't like Superman was like, oh, you know, like we got terrible service at that restaurant. And Lois is like, well, that's because of those immigrants that work at there. You know, it wasn't like that. It was sort of in the broad, the broadest sense of political alignment instead of the more specific idea that I think we have in this country right now about what makes your politics your politics. But what was...
But, you know... So...
wish we just had someone we could have our characters go punch in the face like Hitler.
Yeah. Simple. Yeah, take that, Hitler.
Where's the Osama bin Laden punching in the face?
You know, I feel like there was one, or was there talk of one.
You know, well, that was the Frank Miller Holy Terror.
That's what it was.
Right? Batman. Was that, was it called Holy Terror? Is that
well,
what
I don't want Frank Miller anywhere near terrorism. God knows what he would think.
Well, that was the big discussion is that he was going to do a Batman versus Al Qaeda.
Right,
book.
Right.
So
makes sense.
Sure. Yeah. He's gonna fight the terrorists. Sarah, do you feel that small press or independent is maybe a little bit better ground to cover political issues than mainstream comics? Do you feel one way or the other about that? Because you don't have really an editor or a corporate
right.
master that is telling us like, no, you can't make a book that covers these political
right.
you know, points of view.
In a sense, yes. I mean, because it is small press, you know, comics is a marginalized enough medium as it is, but you go to independent comics and you have an even smaller audience. You go to handmade local independent comics and it's much, I mean, that's where the big bucks is.
That's where all the big money is. Right. Well, each one of your issues costs $700.
Right.
Which is how you make up for all, you know.
But in that sense, I mean, nobody's really paying attention to what we're doing. We don't have a board of directors where, you know, we don't have funding. You know, nobody's saying you can't, you know, these topics are off limits or anything because, you know, there's really not that many people paying attention.
Well, I also think if you work for a big corporation, ultimately all of this stuff sort of comes down to you want to sell it.
Right.
And it kind of doesn't make sense if you own Superman to have Superman piss off a huge part of your public, even say like, I am a Democrat, and I hate, you know, like, it wouldn't make any sense. I mean, not necessarily, wouldn't make sense creatively or economically. I mean, it doesn't, I think, further any storytelling. It doesn't.
Right.
It shuts off a huge part of the people that, you know, that you would, would buy your books. Do you ever worry about when you, doing, like, a small press book? Because I haven't read any of your stuff, so I don't know. I mean, it could be, like, crazy. It could be crazy. Some really crazy shit in here from what I see. I mean, like, robots. And you ever worry about, like, someone picking up your book and, like, being...
Only,
for whatever reason.
Right.
Yeah.
Only in the sense that, you know, when we do a convention and, you know, there's lots of families with children around.
Yeah.
And it's not that our books are smut or filth or anything, but they're, you know, a lot of them do deal with some adult situations.
Yeah.
And if the cover is colorful and a child picks it up, I'm
like, God! Oh,
these ones are age appropriate. This one is not.
This one's for you.
Yeah, I don't want any, like, Gordon Lee situations at the Windy City Comic Con.
Right.
So,
no. I mean, the closest I think that we've even come to that is my own series, The Ouija Interviews, which are based on actual conversations to the Ouija board. And it's only within my own family because I was raised extremely Catholic. My parents are still very, very Catholic. And my mother would look at the books and she'd be like, oh, this looks pretty. You know, I have no
it's
interest
a doorway
in reading
to evil.
This, you know, satanic book that you've written.
It's a doorway to evil.
Sarah, I think we need to pray.
Yeah. We didn't do the Around Comics prayer circle before.
Right.
Yeah. We might have to edit that. No. You might have to edit that in later when we get a chance, where we say our group prayer.
We're gathered here today to talk about comics,
politics, and comics.
But no. So far, I don't think we've pissed anybody off.
Good. Well, good for you.
I think there might be a misconception by, you know, some people out there that comics are a relatively new thing to comics, and politics have been in comics for. Well, since World War II, probably way before that.
Politics are in Oral storytelling has politics. I mean, right. Even Jesus got pissed off at the
Wall Street.
Yeah, the Wall Street. Yeah, you know, like.
Well,
and that's
and
not to s-
it,
well,
I mean,
not to
in
say
a
that
sense,
Bible's
it
fiction. It might be.
Stop that.
But, I mean, it's
in,
part
in
of
a
the.
Sense, I mean, Superman kind of came about because of the comic.
Yeah, he used to fight corrupt landlords and industrialists back in the day.
But the superheroes appeared in the first place because America was facing some, you know, some pretty crazy foes overseas, and it was you know, a new global situation that they had to get used to, and the comics brought about a hero that they could fall back on and still see the situation sort of black and white, good
it's
and
also
evil.
A lot of it's really funny too, because especially with the like the DC comics at the time, it wasn't so much because they tried to stay away from having the superheroes actually fight the Nazis a lot of times, because they were afraid that it would diminish the actual people fighting the Nazis. So,
yeah.
But it took on a weird thing where a lot of times they were fighting like saboteurs at home, or you could join like the Junior Justice Society, and it would have tips on like recycling stuff and like gathering newspapers and how you could help the, you know, help the war effort. So, I mean, in a possibly the most aggressive way possible. They were extremely political in the fact that they were community organizing through comic books.
Yeah, but, yeah, absolutely.
You know, that's not worth anything.
Well, you look at...
I said that again.
Well, you look at Marvel Comics in the 60s, and the 60s were obviously a very politically charged decade.
What?
Yeah, yeah, there was a lot of political stuff going on.
All right, I'll take your word for it.
And, you know, I remember watching a comics documentary on A&E a few years ago, and I think Stan Lee was talking about Spider-Man and Hulk. That and Doctor Strange, that those characters, especially the Hulk and Doctor Strange,
one pill makes you smaller.
that in Doctor Strange's case, that there was an affinity with that character, with the counterculture that was out at the time, especially, you know, the psychedelia and drug use, which to this day I think I know that Stan Lee and if he was still talking to anyone, Steve Ditko would say that book was in no way drug influenced or had any sort of drug overtone to it. They didn't know what was going on in the counterculture.
Well, Eastern mysticism too was big in the 60s.
Sure.
Mystery.
Right.
Well, I mean, they just kind of capped it. They made something that they knew was popular and was selling comics, and that's what they were really worried about. But the Hulk is, I think, if you look at the origins of that character, I mean, he's very much a counterculture character. He was fighting the government and the military, and
he's like
he was the one, you know, this one solitary creature that was standing up against the establishment.
He's like the 60s disenfranchised Superman. You know, Superman shows up in the 30s and he has super strength and he can do whatever he wants, but it's always focused towards landlords and evil industrialists and all of that, because at that time people had more trust in government and more trust in the system to feel that wrongs could be righted by someone who believed in the American, you know, the American ideals. You know, he was the application of all the stuff that America is supposed to be made out of. He was like the ultimate sort of true government that people wanted out of America. And then you look at the Hulk, and the Hulk is all the frustration and all the anger and all like lashing out at everything. You know, the Hulk doesn't trust anyone. The Hulk wants to be left alone. He doesn't want the government near him. He doesn't want anyone near him. He just wants to run off by himself and, you know, be by himself.
Be in a cabin in Idaho and collect his
and
guns.
And I'm sure Stan Lee was thinking of that. I'm sure if you asked him, he would say he was.
Yeah, I don't think so.
I don't think he was.
I don't think he was at all.
I don't think he was thinking that
Hulk
either.
Hulk smash.
But you can see why people are so attracted to it, because it's Superman who doesn't have any ideals. You know, the Hulk is just pure...
He's a force of nature.
He's pure just rage at everything around him. It's not like he has some sort of high morals that he's trying to live up to besides, like, leave me alone and I'll leave you alone. You know, it's sort of the sad turn of the 60s, you know, of all the people start cutting themselves off from society in a way.
You know, we see, you know, the 60s...
I just brought it all down.
The 60s were obviously a politically charged era because of the war. And now that we're seeing in comics again that, you know, we have an overseas conflict, you know, in Iraq right now, and we're starting to see more and more political comics that focus on the war.
Chris, a war on terror just isn't overseas,
my
friend. War on terror isn't just overseas. It's everywhere.
Well,
just fronts everywhere.
Have you...
Politicians have themselves away.
All right, we have one of the guests we talked about, Mr. Hilary Barda. How you doing, sir?
I'm doing fine. I'm leaning forward now, ruining your sound.
No, you're perfect.
I was trying to toot my beer here. Not enough gone there yet.
Trying to toot your horn. Anyway, I was talking about Infinite Horizon, which is a book that Jerry Duggan and Phil Noto are doing, and the premise is that they are retelling the story of the Odyssey. And instead of Troy, it's set in the Middle East. And, you know, a year ago, it seemed, you know, it was like, okay, this is kind of far out. But the premise was, you know, what happens if all of your military is overseas? And then all of a sudden there's a huge worldwide financial collapse and they're left to their own devices to get back home. And it kind of over the last couple weeks, not that, you know, much of a stretch. So, you know, Is it kind of weird sometimes that comics or any other sort of entertainment medium can almost be prophetic about this stuff? You know, is it just that maybe comic book creators may have their ears to the ground a little bit more sometimes?
Well, comics and old movies. Like right now we're sort of watching a Frank Capra film being reenacted where Congress is jumping in to save us from this financial crisis. I'm waiting for George Bailey to come out and say, wait a minute, you don't understand, this is your money.
Money's not here, it's in your
house.
Well, the guys who gave Wall Street the keys to our money are now saying they're going to take more of our money to protect the rest of our money from total collapse. That's I believe that Ponzi scheme, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. We were talking about comics.
What the hell's funny about politics? The room got too quiet.
I think, in a sense, it's the job of any creator, comic book or otherwise, to try to have insight like that. I mean, not specifically try to predict exactly what's going to happen in the next political cycle, but to say, I mean, we'll look at someone like George Orwell. You know, where, you know, the things that he was writing about may have seemed a little far-fetched and crazy at first, but, you know, it certainly, as time has passed, you know, has gotten a little bit closer to reality.
Sure. I have talked to many animals, and not a single one of them has a single political belief in their mind. Pigs, dogs, they don't care. They care nothing about politics.
Georgia, my dog, my pit bull.
Your pit bull does not care.
Well, she doesn't like politicians, but she doesn't like most people in general. So it's kind of hard to tell.
Is your dog a conservative? Neocon.
The animals are libertarians.
The
they don't believe in this government business. The government should get out of the way, and animals should be.
Well,
able
if their doghouse burns down, if their doghouse burns down, let's see who they call.
Just try to get your paws in that speed dial. I don't know. I don't think it's going to work. Though they just talked about a dog who actually hit 911 recently. That was kind of interesting.
Yeah, I did hear about that.
Cute dog.
Was there an emergency?
Always big on TV.
Was there an emergency?
Yeah.
It was.
I mean, a guy had a pre-programmed phone. He would go into a seizure or a coma or whatever medical condition he had. He got stupid, and then the dog would hit the button for him. And it actually worked, and they came. Because, you know, police knew about this setup. They had as soon as his number would come up, they'd go, oh, this is
the
that
dog
guy.
Must have dialed the
number. Dog has dialed the phone.
The dog has dialed
we must
the
go
number.
Rescue that smart dog from that comatose
We're
owner.
Throwing out like 1,000 great comic book ideas right now for a political comic
but,
book.
But Jerry Duggan, I agree with you about bringing in Orwell or something. You know, it's like speculative fiction. When you write about the new, you know, as opposed to Flash
That's
Gordon.
Right, you've worked with Jerry.
Yes. Yes, I have. Mm-hmm. And
what an
Jerry
asshole!
What an asshole! But the guy, that asshole, can predict the future. No, no, it's just they were figuring out a way to bring in the classic story, you know, and I mean, I doubt Jerry was thinking, oh, this is a reality. It's more of a way of a premise of setting up a really interesting story, a situation. The fact that it could happen, well, that makes it more interesting now. Maybe we can sell this, okay? Do we have the actual place they can go order the book online? We can link that to this interview?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Okay, it's good. Infinite Horizon. Go get it.
It's an image book.
It's in single issues now. It was nominated for an Eisner. I need to get in touch with Jerry and find out when the next issue is coming out. It's been a little while, hasn't it?
Yeah, well, I was, for some reason, it made me start thinking about all the times in the old comic books when, and this just popped in my head, when a president would pop up in a comic book, which would make, at the time, obviously, they weren't concerned about dating it, but when, like, Superman is shaking hands with JFK after having just, like, yeah, it's like, oh, yeah, it's, or, whenever Reagan would pop up in a DC comic in, like, the
80s. Oh, God, Dark Knight Returns.
Yeah, right. I mean, it's all over that.
Dark Knight Returns is such a political comic. I mean, Superman is a Republican. Batman is very much an anarchist. It's
Well, politics enters into it. I mean, there's political comics, and we were talking about this prior to going
on live?
Pod or whatever you
going
call it.
Going, quote-unquote, live.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, I mean, there's Joe Sacco's Palestine. And then there's, you know, The Dark Knight Returns or something. I mean, the superhero comics deal with politics in a sort of indirect way. They use it as background to tell an adventure story.
Mm-hmm.
It's the story isn't really about the politics, typically. I'm sure there are exceptions people can bring forward as evidence, but they're exceptions, I think. Politics as a subject matter, actual subject matter, like a story about a strike or something, that's all going to be done in independent comics. It's going to be done by publishers who are not looking at selling to, you know, 5 million teenagers. They're looking for a totally different market.
Well, have you ever thought at Short Pants of doing anything that was like, hey, I feel very strongly about this, you know, this certain political issue, you know.
Right.
Robots.
Right, robots. We actually have one series that we have out right now. An Army of Lovers Will Be Beaten is by Bernie McGovern. We only have the first issue for sale right now, but the second issue is going to come out later this year, I hope in time for the Windy City Comic Con.
Mm-hmm.
It is vaguely political. It's about a war. The story is more about, like, the individual lives of the soldiers. So there's not a whole lot of overt politics that enters into it. But the war is this ridiculous, foolhardy war that these generals have ordered them go on, and everybody knows that it's silly. It's a war against the stars in the night sky. They're actually trying to shoot the stars.
Are they freedom
out
haters?
Of the sky. Right, yeah.
Do they hate freedom?
The
they
stars
freedom?
Are, yeah. The stars are commies. They're the red.
Elitists up on their ivory towers looking down.
But, you know, and again...
It's so it's an allegory.
It is an allegory, pretty much.
They're not actually... No, never mind.
So wait a second. I understand.
Let's get Jerry on the phone to talk to us about whether he was actually trying to predict a future. Whether he woke up one night in a sweat and said, oh my God, I know what's going to happen. I've got to do the comic book.
But, you know, we're talking about war comics, and, you know, it's one of the things that, you know, I love music, and I listen to a lot of different kinds of music, and no matter what Sal says, my catalog is not just filled with Sarah McLachlan and Sheryl Crow records. There's a few of them.
Jug bands in there, too.
But
I pulled his iPod away from his ear, and all I heard is, fuck the police!
Coming straight out of
WA.
I got a letter from the government. I'm not going to do that. You know, one of the things I've been very disappointed in music is the lack of protest songs. And Steve Earle is one of my favorite singer-songwriters, and he's one of the few people I feel that's out there that's really actively writing protest songs. And you just don't see that anymore. And I think it's just, you know, the corporatization of music since...
Well, they're out there. There's a lot of...
There's a lot
of very political music. I was around listening to the radio in the 60s. And I heard a lot more of it that was on top 40 radio.
Right.
And you know, just think about Marvin Gaye or any number of...
Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Sometimes Young.
Yes. Yeah. The Impressions before that. There was a lot of stuff in the Civil Rights.
Curtis Mayfield.
Yeah, Curtis Mayfield, one of the great songwriters and political songwriters. The Turtles, sure. But...
You know, but it's the same kind
Anti-monarchy.
Well, you know, I I almost feel in a weird way that I feel I see more protest comic books now than I hear protest music. And it's maybe because comics are even a little bit more underground.
Sure.
And you know, and there are underground comics.
You're also probably far more actively searching for comic books, though, than you are for music.
Yeah.
I mean,
especially stuff that is appealing to the 18 to 24 year old set that's going to be more in tune with more politically active music.
I don't know if you're going to get a Beyonce protest song. Maybe. Who knows?
I mean,
she has a new album dropping.
The week that's ending here was the last week was World Music Week in Chicago, and I heard a bunch of different bands from all over the world, and some of the stuff was on the radio, and they had rappers from Africa doing protest songs, you know, rapping, and the guy mixing the beats was from Europe and whatever. Totally political stuff. In the context of rap. I mean, the rap, you know, is kind of tough guy, gangsta stuff on one level, and then protesting about poverty and, you know, children being forced into serving in armies. I mean, I don't think you can say that stuff's not out there. It just doesn't make it to the level of, you know, the pop culture sort of tapped into in the 60s, tapped in 70s, I suppose, early 70s, tapped into that in a different way. Because it was sort of there. I've been frustrated my whole life, adult life, with that political thing, sort of that edge being lost. But that's also because I'm not in touch with what's going on. It's just on a radar that I'm not watching anymore. I can't pick this stuff up. Kids are on the internet, probably, you know, all blogging about politics.
Sure,
and
sure.
Their mm-hmm. opinions and whatever. It's being expressed. It's being thought about. But I think it might have been lost for a while. The 80s certainly was a decade. In some way,
it's more of a floodlight than a laser beam. Now it's just things are.
I think
are
culture
so,
is more.
It's diffused.
It is diffused. It's more diffused. I think that's true. Yes, but I mean, move on. MoveOn.org or something.
God,
like that. How many people
involved?
Fucking
emails I get from Move On.
Yeah, you and Barack Obama, right?
Yeah, I get it like two a day, and but David. David, whatever his name is, he's the campaign manager.
my ultra-conservative uncle signed me up for the Republican Lord. National Committee email list. Thank
That's
you, Uncle
That's a bold
Pete.
Move to sign someone else up for, like,
yeah.
a political
yeah, so
emailing list.
I get Orrin Hatch emails every
That's
day.
That's going to I have a great new practical joke that I think I'm going to be signing up a lot of my friends for the Republican National Committee.
Speaking of the 60s and the old days, when you told me about the subject matter, I was thinking of like comics I read when I was a kid, and they used to handle politics. Like in the 60s, Stan Lee would do these books, and plus the writers he brought in, Roy Thomas, mm-hmm. And a lot of guys that followed, tried to be hip. And most of it is incredibly dorky.
It's still true today. Most people are usually like five or six years really behind
yeah.
what's actually cool.
One of the first big ones. Sorry to cut you off there.
Yeah.
One of the
He's
first big ones that I
out of my mouth. I don't even like the taste of your book.
A book that was you know. Right in your face political was Denny O'Neill and Neil Adams Green Lantern Black or
Green
Lantern
Arrow.
Green Arrow.
Yeah.
I wanted to say a Black Canary. So that's
well it was
that's
political it. No. What it really was, I mean yes, there's political stuff. It was kind of like current events. You know, I mean it wasn't like our agenda is to overthrow the government. It was more like
Black Panther. This is the issue with the Black Panther.
No, they have an issue dealing with heroin and addiction. There's an issue dealing with racism. You know, and
overpopulation.
Yeah, but I remember
American
yes,
Indian biker gangs.
I remember that. But what I was thinking of is these hilarious things that they did at Marvel, where, like, you know, this leader of this guy who is fomenting, you know, some kind of racist, you know, kind of movement, like a Klan kind of thing, but it was something in Iron Man, and they're all wearing hoods, right, kind of, you know, suggest a Klan-like thing, but I forget if it was, they did this with Hydra or somebody like that, some organization. But at the end, they tear off the hood of this guy, and, you know, you think, oh, he's going to be white or he's going to be black. No, he's this super villain guy, you know, who's just, he's not really a racist,
well,
he's just doing
that?
This to over... You know, it was just in service of a silly plot.
In the Fantastic Four, when that one villain got the hate monger got unmasked, and it was Hitler.
Yeah.
It was like, that might have been a little too...
Whoa!
Like, all right then, I guess.
And they went there.
They're still alive, I guess. And that story.
Yeah. What were we... that really happened? That really happened?
Yeah,
did Byrne do that?
Who, no, this was Will, Kirby.
Oh, it was Kirby. Oh, really?
This was...
I totally forgot this.
And Jack Kirby. Wow. The hate mongers got this ray that makes people hate. And, like, they have... It was sort of an unnecessary reveal because the character in and of himself, I thought, was actually... It was sort of an interesting commentary sort of on, like, the nature of hate. And then the sort of unnecessary reveal that it was Hitler. Like,
anytime there's a guy in a hood, there's going to be an unnecessary reveal, right? You have to yank that off. It's,
well, that's not that... the first time I read that, when I was reading, like, Fantastic Four Essential, and I was like, so wait, Hitler is going to be... I'm like,
I
so...
completely forgot about this.
Is Hitler going to be a reoccurring villain for Fantastic Four? As a kid, I was like, is he going to show up again? Is Hitler going to team up with the Skrulls?
I mean, look, man, you can never get a better villain than Nazis, so...
They do it today. Hellboy goes back to that well over and over again.
It's true.
There's hardly a Hellboy issue that doesn't have a Nazi in it, or a floating Nazi head in a jar. But even, you know, Captain America to this day, the main rogues...
The Skull...
Arnim Zola, you've got, you know, Faust.
Baron Zemo. All these guys came from another era.
Absolutely.
You know, they came from the Cold War, if not World War
but
II.
But they still work. It's like the Red Skull is still out there running around.
Well, Red Skull conveniently switches his political alliance with whatever America hates at the time. You know? Like, communist.
But bringing up Captain America reminds you of Steve Englehart in the 70s was writing Captain America, and he did this thing. I mean, if you recall the history of Captain America, and I'm sure we all do.
Everyone wants to
sure.
Why don't you tell us?
Sarah?
We're going to have a Sarah Palin moment here.
All right, Sarah, for 10 points, tell me what Captain America's shield is made of.
You don't understand. I lived right by Captain America.
Is it adamantium? No, I'm kidding.
And vibranium. Alloy.
Captain America existed as a character in the 40s. He fought Nazis. Then there were these, you know, there were books in the 50s, and Captain America was resurrected. They said he came out of a, he was taken out of a flow from some breaking off of an iceberg. Or
something. He froze.
The 1940s froze. Captain America had frozen. Well, Englehart wrote this story where, well, what about that guy in the 50s? And so his explanation was this was like the evil Captain America. They were both guys created by this same super soldier formula that the government had injected this guy with to battle the Nazis.
That would be Dr. Erkstein.
Okay, yeah.
Wow. Nerd alert.
In any case, the reason he brought this guy forward is not just to explain comics, you know, history to
Erskine.
Continuity Erskine. Morons, but to deal with this whole political thing where this guy was a psychotic, you know, red-hating 1950s guy who was just, you know, he took over as Captain America, and the real Captain America renamed himself as Nomad because he's like, well, I'm a man without a country. If they're going to support this kind of thing, I'm leaving. And this was basically at the right around the time of the rise of the Reagan conservatism, right before he got into office, of course. But, you know, this is comics dealing with politics in a, you know, a pretty successful way because it worked as a comic that dealt with the characters that existed. And yet it brought in, you know, they weren't calling, you know, Nixon wasn't a character. They weren't dealing...
It's not Watchmen where Nixon's an...
But the current politics of the day came into play and affected these adventure action storylines.
Hi, I'm Ed Brubaker. When I'm not waiting for the trade, I like to listen to a Round Comics podcast.
All right, well, Sarah, you told me a little bit earlier that you would, or before you ever got into comics,
right.
Your kind of first love was political cartoons.
That's true. When I was in high school and college, I did political cartoons for the school newspapers, and I really thought that that's what I wanted to be for a while.
Hard-hitting high school.
Yeah, exactly. You know, criticizing the latest mixer and the music choices.
I think the whole
ice cream social is corrupt.
We should
top to bottom.
We should totally have pizza on Fridays.
Dom this was junior.
This was grade school.
No, this is that. Well, okay, criticizing the mixer was high school.
I did cartoons for the paper in high school.
Yeah,
and they were as political as issues in high school.
Exactly.
But they were, you know, about the budget being slashed for the art department and stuff like that. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, so in college, political. I, you know, branched out to a little more, you know, hard hit, like actual politics, not just school politics. But yeah, I sort of lost my taste for it when I realized that I didn't feel like I was seeing the issues in black and white enough terms. You know, political comics, political cartoonists, you know, they really only get like the one panel or the four panels. It has to be a real quick message, one two punch, and can really only show one side of the issue. You can't get into like all of the complexities that go behind anything that you're talking about.
It's almost anti-complexity because you're trying to do a visual image containing some very clear idea.
Exactly. You're trying to distill it all down to like just one little picture. But part of the reason that I wanted to get into it was, you know, growing up, my grandfather had a number of the Walt Kelly Pogo books. And you know, as a child, I read them, and I loved them because there were animals, and they were funny, and they were doing funny things. Going back and rereading them when I got older, I realized, you know, how steeped all of his imagery and all of his characters and storyline were with the politics of the time. You know, you get to enjoy it on a completely new level. Everything, you know, from McCarthyism to just, like, the ridiculousness of a political campaign.
Right.
Yeah. Well, speaking of
Simple J. Mularkey, I just remembered.
That's what it was.
That was Kelly's name for his McCarthy character, who was... He was like a badger or something,
no,
maybe? Because he came from Wisconsin. He might have been a badger. Yeah, McCarthy. Badger, yeah.
I'm sorry, Tom.
He's from Appleton. Appleton sucks.
Ed Gein and McCarthy. What else has Wisconsin given us?
Fighting Joe LaFollette.
Okay, good.
Yeah, he was good. Very progressive.
Yeah, I know. Actually, there is a history of progressive politics.
Yeah,
there.
Exactly.
Where has it gone?
What's the big student political organization in Madison?
In Madison? Wisperg or whatever.
Oh, hey, the Onion started.
The SAS?
SAS was in Madison for a while, yeah, when all those crazies, they blew up the chemistry building. The political cartoon thing made me think, when you said it's really hard to, like, have, it's almost anti sort of complexity, it just makes me respect Bill Keen even more for, like, batting 1,000 on Family Circus, of always nailing all the issues that he's covering about, like, ghosts. And like sharing.
Every time I go to my 87-year-old mom's house, there's another Family Circus pinned up on the refrigerator.
Don't mock the circus. Or Billy's circuitous path to the, you know, like he nails it every time. But in Green Bay, the political cartoonist, there has to be the easiest political cartoonist job because once a week, he always gets to do one about the Packers.
Right.
You know, like, it's like, if he doesn't have anything to do, he'll just be like, all right, we'll just do one about the Green Bay Packers.
There you go, every Monday.
With two of them sometimes during the season. Doesn't matter.
Oh,
and at least one.
Once a week, even in the off season, right?
Yeah, hunting. Yeah, this is all year. And then when hunting season comes around, you can inevitably have a hunting season one. Then he started doing this thing that really pissed me off where they had a contest where he drew it and then the readers got to put the captions in there. And inevitably the winner...
We did that as a contest on Around Comics.
I know. Well, I like to think our listeners are slightly more sophisticated than
You like to think that.
Like to think that. Not a bunch of writing and talking.
When I was in junior high school, the murders, the students being shot by troopers at Kent State occurred.
Right.
And this is in the 70s. And there was also something going on in our school where this vice principal, who was kind of a real tough guy, had sprained a kid's arm when he was trying to restrain him. This, you know, incident, which who knows what really happened there. But the thing was, is we wanted to protest. We wanted the school to fly the flag at half-mast because we, meaning several students, a small group of us, friends of mine.
Oh, you freaks.
We were freaks and hippies back then. We had long hair. So this is junior high school, and we actually walked out of our classes and went, and we were in the hall. We just sat down in the hall and said, we want you to fly the flag at half-mast, and we also wanted them to fire this principal or put them up on charges or whatever we wanted. Anyway, it sort of got more crowded because kids saw that we were, you know, skipping classes, and they started joining us. And at some point, we were actually, some of us would go into other classes and tell the teachers that there was an assembly meeting. We just made this up. Because the teacher said, you can't stay in the hall. This is a fire hazard. And so they moved us to the gym. And then we just said, well, we don't want, you know, someone to be grabbing, you know, the front of the hall. They'd grab the kids and say, hey, we don't let them tell us where to go. We're going to take over the assembly hall. So that's what we did. We moved across the hall, took over this big space. And that's when we started going to the sixth grade classes and saying, there's an assembly meeting. So these sixth grade teachers would just get their kids to march single file into this radical, you know, crazy thing going on, because the sixth graders had no idea probably just what we were even, what the issues
were. Jefferson airplane, plane, they were still the labs. And
yeah. And we'll, you know, but the whole thing had this, you know, it was funny because it was like in microcosm, it was something like a 1984 or whatever. You could just see the whole thing devolve very quickly, where eventually guys were, you know, like standing on stage and not letting other kids get up there. They became the security guards and people were screaming into the microphone, and it all became a mess pretty quickly. But it was still was a kind of a fascinating, you know, thing to be a part of, just to see how quickly it could happen and how we really did shut the school down that day. So there you go. There's my little radicalism as a kid.
You're radical. Did you ever graduate from grade school?
Well, that was junior high.
Junior high? So that was pretty much then.
That was it, huh?
Yeah, I was, I was blackballed. I couldn't be educated in Illinois after that.
And then he entered a career in comic books.
Well, actually, we moved to California for 1 year. I was in California, and the fascinating thing about it for me was because we became very political. People were running on students being more represented in the decisions around the school. When I was in California, I was in L.A., and in fact, I lived in Brentwood, which is a pretty tony area. And they had an assembly for the elections, right? This is when everyone gave up. They were giving their speeches for class president. It was like acting tryouts. They were doing an audition. They all were acting. Somebody sang a song. It was like a variety show. Somebody got up there and he did his Jerry Lewis Nutty Professor thing. He came up as the Nutty Professor and he's like, the student body, and he turned around and he was Joe Cool. He said, so vote for me, Joe Cool. And I'm like,
wow,
what the fuck is this? So it was totally apolitical. And this is California. And it was like, you know, I was like, wow, the West Coast, you know, L.A. anyway, had no idea what was going on.
I mean, you're from Chicago.
Yeah, we were shutting our school down.
Yeah.
Did you nightstick that guy?
No, but there were plenty of drugs in California. I'll give them that.
You know, we've talked about all sorts of different, you know, comics here, but, you know, with the Walt Kelly, you know, we talk about, you know, now like strips, and if you want to talk about politics in comics, I mean, the political cartoon, the editorial strip, or, you know, or the single panel editorial cartoon, is that's a huge part of politics in comics,
right?
Whether it's conservative
or
liberal. You know?
Well, I mean, Doomsbury's got to be the longest running political, you know, it talks
and
about
possibly the only one that's still successful. I mean, it's sort of a dying art form. It's not.
Well, Doomsbury, I mean, it kind of has the distinction of being, I mean, it left the funny pages and it got moved to editorial.
Right.
And I remember.
In single cartoons would be moved if they dealt with a particularly sensitive issue or something that would upset people. They would just pull that and stick it. Some papers would cut them, and some would put them.
You don't
in
want that next to your High and Lois.
They're very. Yeah. Well, I mean,
even though Calvin and Hobbes could be very deep sometimes.
Yeah. And this sort of brings to my mind this whole issue of this, like, people go, oh, you know, that's politics. You know, it's not entertainment. That's, they're trying to send a message. Just, we should, you know, it's like politics shouldn't have a role in entertainment for some reason. Like, there's something. They don't mix somehow. Like, why? Why is that so? What, you know, and
I think sometimes people who are creative do themselves a disservice. It almost seems sometimes people who are, like, really good musicians or really great actors or creators or something, sometimes I think the problem where people think that entertainment shouldn't mix with politics is because they don't use their craft to talk about their politics. They use their personality to talk about it, and it never works as well as if they use their skill. It's like Moby. You know, Moby, anytime I hear Moby talk about, like, his political thoughts, I'm always like, oh, it's like, but when he uses his creativity to do it, it's more effective and, like, more poignant and less, because he's not a great orator, you know, that's not his skill that he's the best at doing, you know.
Right.
He's a creative musician. So yeah. Use that to do it. I think sometimes that's where people get... Because you get that thing where people are like, oh, Hollywood actors are all, you know, a bunch of liberals, and I'm sick of them telling me what, you know, what to do. You know, and
it almost does work to the detriment of what they're trying to say.
I think sometimes some people are pretty good at, you know, like Tim Robbins is someone who is pretty outspoken, but also does creative things, which I think also speak to that. While some people sort of use their politics outside of, like, their craft in a way. You know, like Matt Damon, you know, is a big... pretty big, outspoken, like, political person, but mm-hmm. I can't think of too many times he's done anything creatively. I mean, he writes movies. I mean, you haven't seen that come through that way.
Well,
I think.
You try to get a yeah. political script made in Hollywood, and you tell me, you know, no matter how big you are. I mean, Tom Cruise wanted to make his... I mean, actually, I guess he was in they did that political thing, a Redford film not too long ago, with it, right? Wasn't that Cruise and
yeah.
Redford in it?
He did that. He did the... I forget
Meryl
what it was
Street,
called.
Maybe,
about the war or something.
Or Clint Close.
Yeah, yeah, something about the war. Or
and it bombed.
I think that's the only
in
way.
In fact, most of the films that deal with, you know, vets or Iraq, pretty either directly or just with the home front or whatever, haven't done any box office, which they keep making them, though. That's kind of interesting. They made maybe four of them already.
Yeah, I think
they will keep making them, too.
Well, and that's different, because it took a long time for them to make films about Nam, really deal with it, as opposed to just sort of, you know, like the Green Berets by
John took a while Wade for John Rambo to win that.
That's right. That's right.
So, yeah, you know, one of those...
To go back and rescue John McCain.
Well, yeah, well, you could get into a whole Rambo discussion about the first Rambo versus the...
Well, Tom, I find it a little weird that you keep comparing your life to Rambo.
John Rambo's life, yeah.
That's
yeah,
well, always Sunny in Philadelphia.
I'm walking through town, and I'm traveling through towns, and I got shoved by some sheriff who didn't like me.
That was First Blood.
That was Rambo First Blood. I always think it's funny with the Rambo First Blood, is sort of like this tale about how, you know, it's still like an action movie, but it's also kind of a tale about how badly we treat people that we use for like a certain goal, and they come back and they don't have anything, and we just want them to disappear. And then the second Rambo was about him sort of winning the Vietnam War. It's like, that was kind of whole 180
how quickly they go to the money.
Yeah, exactly. Like, wait a second. We could just send him there and he could win.
This movie brought to you by the U.S.
But the most common way politics enter into anything in terms of, you know, popular culture is through metaphor. I mean, and, you know... In a way, the way we deal with politics here in movies and stuff is not much different than the way they dealt with it, you know, behind the Iron Curtain. I mean, they had to deal with it in metaphor, you know, and allegory. They couldn't directly state, we're against Stalin, or we don't like the system, or this is... They would come up with some historical parable or something, and their audience knew it, and often these guys got in trouble because they read everything as carefully as they could, but... Here we really do the same thing. We talk around things. They'll come up with a really we're going to tackle this issue, and then they just wimp out on it, and they don't actually really get into it and deal with it. It just doesn't happen here very often.
Well, I mean, there is a point where, I mean, this is escapist material that, you know, a lot of us read comics or watch movies or,
but not all movies are. I mean, the dramatic films are not supposed to be escapist, and yet they wimp out. They typically wimp out.
Okay, I can see
that. They typically wimp out.
I think what it is, though, too, is I think if you want to make something that a lot of people will watch and it has, like, a message to it, you almost have to trick them in a way into watching it. If people know ahead of time, like, this is going to be heavy, I think there's a tendency for people to not... to avoid it in a way.
There is an anti-intellectual, you know, bias in the American public in their entertainment. They don't want to be sold something. And the thing is, that's like a tradition. It's hard to sort of say, oh, we're going to break that. But you can create a dynamic piece of work, and it breaks through that.
You trick 'em.
Roger Moore has certainly found an audience with diatribes, you know, films that are essentially diatribes.
Use and humor.
Political cartoons in many ways, you know. Very blunt instruments, but he gets a lot of attention because of it, and he's got a big audience because
he
of
just
it.
Came
Michael
out
Moore?
Did I say who did?
You said Roger,
Roger
Moore.
Moore.
I was like, I love
it. Roger Moore.
Actually, Roger Moore, you don't know about that the Bond film they wouldn't release.
Wow.
I think I can.
Timothy
Roger
Dalton.
And me.
Timothy Dalton was less successful was than like, Roger Moore. It is.
I was like, okay, not Octopussy, maybe the Spirit.
Yeah, that's who I meant. Right, Roger Moore.
Roger.
Actually, I meant Mandy Moore. I don't know who I'm talking about anymore.
He's got some great political songs.
Yeah,
I'm a little freaked out.
Some
there.
Roger Moore. Pierce Brosnan, your future awaits. Political.
Roger Moore.
A View to a Kill. That's one of the great political.
A View to an Economic Crisis.
Well, on that
Live
note,
and Let Die. Mm-hmm. It's all about sort of the plight of the Third World.
Live and Let Diatribe.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I tell you what. Let's go ahead and wrap this one up. I think we could talk about it ad nauseum. But
we've got to go save Wall Street and the American economy.
Yeah,
suspending the show.
Oh, you know,
we have to suspend the show in order to do that.
I totally
cannot continue with the podcast.
I totally screwed this up at the beginning. I was supposed to let everyone
have a joke written.
I do. I have a joke written. It said that Sal today at work wanted me to let everyone know that he couldn't make it to the podcast tonight because he has to go and fix a financial crisis at home. Otherwise, he would be here. But he thinks that's
probably
much
better.
More,
than
boy, I'm
more
glad you saved that to the end. They might not have stayed with us.
Oh, no, I know.
All right.
We tricked you. We tricked.
We saved the good stuff. Folks.
We masked it with entertainment to get.
Hillary Barda, here's the pimpage part of the podcast. What do you have coming up, good sir?
Well, I just actually earlier today I was writing a story for Fear Agent. I've got a few stories coming out in Fear Agent. Yeah, it's about the politics of punching aliens in the face.
You like know, immigrants?
Yeah.
We were going to try and talk with Rick a little bit earlier, and he's watching the political debate. And if you have a chance, pick up the Tales from the Fear Agent one-shot called 12 Steps in One, and I think it may be collected in the Tales of the Fear Agent trade paperback. Very, very political story for Fear Agent, and you know there's a slimy Dick Cheney character in there, and you know it's definitely left leaning, but a lot of fun. I enjoyed it.
Yeah.
So
if you go to Munden's Bar Stories, I've got a few of those coming out. I've got one online now, and that's at Comic Mix, comiccomix.com. And
what's that?
That's mostly what I've been doing. I'm working on a few other things that I'll tell you about in the future.
Well, who's doing Comic Mix? People may not know who is behind Comic Mix.
Who's behind Comic Mix? The man behind the curtain?
Yeah.
Well, there's a bunch of people who have money.
But Mike Gold.
But Mike Gold, mm-hmm. who worked as an editor at DC Comics before that, he was one of the founders of First Comics, is the sort of creative driving force in the editorial department there. And Mike, and in fact, a lot of the people from First Comics, John Sable's doing John Sable, or excuse me, Mike Grell's doing John Sable freelance.
Fictional character
John Sable is doing Mike Grell freelance. I have no idea what I'm talking about anymore. I must be tired. But and Grimjack, John Ostrander, Tim Truman's book is being revived. There's a lot of stuff that was going on at first. Munden's Bar was at first in mm-hmm. Grimjack, but there's also a bunch of new stuff. And
if you go to
all free online at comicmix.com.
One of the other podcasts that I'm on weekly, 11 o'clock comics, the forum at bullpenbulletins.com/forums. The part of the forum that we post in is called Munden's Bar.
Oh, okay, so, cool.
Yeah, it's a grim
check. Heather will be expecting a check.
Yes. Plug, plug, plug.
Plug, plug, plug.
No, I don't. Yeah.
Sarah Beacon.
Yeah.
Stuff
nice.
Coming up from Short Pants Press.
Not a Czech creative robot, mind you.
Yeah.
Sorry, Sarah.
A little information on Short Pants Press if people want to check out the stuff that you either work on or the stuff that Short Pants puts out.
Right. Well, if you our website is shortpantspress.com, and we've got a little store there where you can buy comics and Our deal is that we try to find artists, talented and creative artists from the Middle West. Most of our artists are from Chicago or St. Louis, that maybe people wouldn't have access to otherwise, people that they haven't heard of. Our most recent publication is the Short Pants Observer, which is the first of a fairly ambitious project. If this doesn't completely...
I'm holding the comic to the microphone.
Can you hear it?
If it doesn't completely bankrupt us, we're going to keep going and do as many as we can. But it's an anthology project, so every issue is going to showcase four artists. This first one has Jeremy Tinder in it and Becca Taylor.
Hey, I live in Logan Square.
Yes, yeah. I do too.
Jeremy?
So does Jeremy Tinder and so does Becca.
Wow.
Anya Davidson and Corinne Mucha. And all very talented artists.
Jeremy Tinder's very good.
Yes, he's fantastic. He's probably the biggest name in this issue.
And his story is Forever?
His story is called Forever.
Yeah, it looks great.
And we pretty much gave them free rein to do whatever they wanted for, 15 pages, give or take. And this is the first issue. Jeremy Tinder did the cover too. It's a brilliant cover.
I would
wrap around.
For folks out there that obviously can't see this, I would encourage anyone that is a fan of a lot of top shelf publications,
yes,
that a lot of the stuff that I'm seeing that you brought here fits very much into the top shelf mode, as it's not elitist,
is
very accessible, but it is not mainstream comics.
Right. No superheroes to speak of.
However,
if
you are
loving cats.
If you are an elitist, you might enjoy it as well.
Yeah, that's true.
If you're a snob, you might enjoy it. If you're a working man, the hard hat crowd might like this.
I recognize this one, the Sock Monster collection. That's Neil Berdow,
yes, he's got a webcomic, and this is his first print collection.
And Neil is going to be at the Windy City Comic Con as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, which an easy way, if you want to find either Hillary's limericks online or Short Pants Press, you can just go to the Windy City Comic Con site. There, Sarah is on our exhibitors page with Short Pants Press, and Hillary is on our guest page. So. So go and check that out.
Look at it, fools!
Yes. And
participate
and come to the Windy City Comic Con, and you can meet everybody that's here today.
Them. So send me your limerick.
I want to thank everyone that left us an iTunes music review. That would be Oi Bob, Paul Avast, Mpalo, and Hail Fredonia. So thank you, folks.
Hail Fredonia, land of the free.
It's a great way to help other people find the show and know about the show. So if you haven't left an iTunes music review, please go do so. It does help out the show quite
a
bit.
To war. Fredonia's going to war.
Tom versus the Flash.
Yeah, I'm doing that.
Yes, I know you are.
I put up a new episode last night and realized I cut off the end. So someone had to email me, though, because I don't listen to it.
By the way, we were referring to Duck Soup there, and that's a great political comedy.
It is. Anyway, when I was a kid, I loved the Marx Brothers, and I did that.
Oh, absolutely.
Because there's a channel in Green Bay that was like this really low-rent UHF station that, like, in the middle of the day would play Marx Brothers movies at, like, 11 o'clock. So during the summer, instead of playing outdoors when it was nice, I would be sitting indoors watching Marx Brothers movies and then watching like old horror movies afterwards, because that's what they would follow it with, be like Frankenstein or the Wolfman.
Or Frankenstein meets the Wolfman.
One of my favorite moments is at the end of that movie when the actual war is taking place, which is mostly a pie fight at some point. But or they're throwing vegetables or whatever, fruit at the one general. But Harpo walks by with a sandwich board on, which makes fun of all the, the military ads for servicemen. It's been going on since then, but it says, join the Army and see the Navy. I love that.
That's awesome.
That's perfect, yeah.
Now I'm going to have to go home and buy some Marx Brother DVDs.
Yes.
There you go.
Wait for the Blu-ray.
Support the brothers.
Support
Marx. Speaking of being political. Yeah.
Whoa.
Ooh, Hillary.
Sorry. Yeah, I know, because we can't talk about socialism now, because, you know, it's such a bad word now that we're bailing out
our entire economy. Yeah, now that we bought all the... Yeah, exactly.
No, no more socialism here.
No. You socialize the losses. Yeah. You privatize the profits.
I love how the Republicans are saying this is un-American. It wasn't un-American to, you know, totally deregulate these guys and the mortgage, you know, brokers, and so now we're in this crisis to begin with.
Is that Hulk comic American. You're talking about?
Yeah. Hulk smashed the economy!
That was... Wasn't there... there was a Defenders issue that was all about deregulation.
That's right. D is for deregulation.
Steve Gerber had a big deregulation issue.
Yeah, you would have a character... You know, we didn't mention it, but...
We didn't mention Steve Gerber.
Well, the deregulator would be like a character that would pop... A villain that would pop up in Howard the Duck.
And perhaps.
Credit cards. I remember there was one guy who was just made out of, like, credit cards, if I remember correctly.
Oh, the... if you read... pick up the Omnibus. It's brilliant. And the first issue of Howard the Duck is the bad guy is pro rata, and he's an evil mystical accountant.
I am offended by that.
I know
being
you are.
An accountant. There's nothing mystical or evil about me. Just depressed. Sort of sad.
Just depressed.
I believe the mystical part of that, but I don't know.
Is there any prove
that you're not evil.
You
can't just say you're not evil.
I do things that are good.
Sometimes. To offset the bad.
I've made deals with certain mystical beings. There have been who are of interesting moral alignments. I wouldn't say evil. Evil is such a... It's a long term. The winners write history. I mean, that's the problem, you know?
Yeah.
The devil won.
Yeah. Right.
I mentioned earlier about 11 o'clock comics. I'm on there every
don't
week.
Listen to
with
it. It's an old man podcast.
Hey, this week's was good.
Yeah.
It was good. We enjoyed it.
So what's this whole drunken comics thing? What's that? Drinking
Wood needs his own show.
Yes, he does.
He needs to just speak, because he speaks the truth.
He does.
All you jokers.
But did you hear him peeing while we were recording?
Yeah, exactly.
Jerk.
That's what you guys deserve.
Jerk.
So
what? It was like, what is... Somebody...
We do this
over Skype. It's like, is somebody peeing?
A bunch of old men complaining that... Where are the new Marvel handbooks? Jesus Christ. Like, kids these days are going to fucking read Marvel handbooks.
Most people read their comics in the crapper. Yeah. Why not talk about them in there as well?
Forget the internet.
I'm peeing, dude. I'm like, dude, are you 12? But yeah,
I want an all-wood episode.
Hey, it may happen.
We just talked.
He was actually thinking about doing a Wood versus the Avengers.
He should.
Put it on your feed.
Oh, that's a lot of extra work for me.
So you can check out 11 o'clock comics on Thursday or Friday whenever Vince P does. I do that with Vince and David and Wood, and it's just a fun alcohol meets comics. And speaking about alcohol meets comics, I write a weekly column called Comic Shots, where I match a cocktail with a comic book.
You'd be making money off of some of this with the amount of shitty
fucking... I mean you can find that at iFanboy.com.
You just got to name the brand of alcohol that goes into the cocktail every week, and you'll be well on your way towards a sponsor. It couldn't hurt.
Okay, Fortune Brands, I'm coming after you.
What is it going to hurt to start naming names?
Hey, Knob Creek.
Get that bell working, man.
Oh, where's the bell?
Yeah, the bell down here, see?
So check that out, iFanboy, every Thursday. All right, I want to thank Mark, as always, for hosting us here at Dark Tower Comics.
Yeah.
And Sarah Beacon, Hilary Barta, our guest today, and Tom, as always.
Sam Adams Beer and Miller Brewing Company.
Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
Shemayel from Belgium. They're going to send us money.
Hey, well, they own Budweiser now, or that's InBev. We'll be back again Monday with another full-length episode of Our Own Comics. Hope you enjoyed our discussion on politics and comics. There'll be other podcasts.
Go vote. That.
Go to comicrelated.com, then go vote. And
Early and often.
Cheat.
Have a great week and weekend. We'll be back next Monday. In the meantime...
You ain't cheating. You ain't trying.
We'll be everywhere in...
When?
And around comics.
I have nothing.
Come on, Tom.
That's it. That was all you
very
got.
Very close to Alaska.
This is in the bassinet. From underneath the third world horse that I get. I told her I was pulling up and heading west. Said she would have come, but she was overdressed. Put a big postcard of a Midwest bank. She told me that she showed it to a new friend, Franco. Noticed in the window of the 19th floor. I got my age about to prove the man can't soar. He would also like to know if I could just check around before I left this town. Stonewall corner till the tumbles down. So this may not be my best day, but this ain't no golden age.
Expressed in the interviews or by guests of the show are solely those of the individuals expressing them and may not reflect the opinions of Around Comics. Any reproduction, rebroadcast, or retransmission without the express written consent of Around Comics is strictly prohibited. All content presented in this program is the sole property of Around Comics, and this has been an Around Comics production, copyright 2008.
You did not want to see me go, but I did not want